Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a warning from the Drug Enforcement Administration that 2 out of 5 counterfeit pills of oxycodone, Adderall, and Percocet sold by dealers online through Snapchat and other sites popular with teenagers are laced with fentanyl and are potentially lethal, having caused close to 100,000 overdose deaths last year. Joining us is Sam Quinones, a journalist, author, and storyteller whose acclaimed books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and his latest out in November, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We'll discuss how in fentanyl, traffickers found a painkiller 100 times more powerful than morphine, which they could lace with cocaine, meth, and counterfeit pills and market over the internet to teenagers who often don't have the tolerance for hard drugs. With drug traffickers acting like corporations and corporations like traffickers, we will explore the role of the Chinese Communist government in not stopping the manufacture of fentanyl and its precursors, and Purdue Pharma's Sackler family as the initiators of the gateway drug that led to this ongoing opioid epidemic. Then, with 70 million Americans still not vaccinated in the midst of the contagion of the lethal Delta strain of COVID, we will look into the growing use of religious exemptions by anti-vaxxers and speak with Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America, and we will discuss the lies underpinning the evangelicals' resistance to vaccines, claiming they are manufactured from aborted fetuses, even though the Pope and the Catholic Church have approved the use of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Then finally, we'll speak with Christopher Shaw, an author, historian, and policy analyst who is the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic, and his forthcoming book, First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. He joins us to discuss his recent article at Foreign Affairs, The U.S. Postal Service Was Designed to Serve Democracy, and how Trump's Postmaster General, who is under FBI investigation, is deliberately slowing down the mail in a shift from airmail to trucking that will enrich his former trucking company he holds a financial stake in. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Sam Quinones, who is a journalist, author, and storyteller whose 2 acclaimed books of narrative fiction about Mexico and Mexican immigration, True Tales from Another Mexico and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, made him, according to the San Francisco Chronicle Book Review, quote, the most original writer on Mexico and the border. And his latest books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, out in November. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Quinones.
Thanks very much, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Sam. And it seems that there is a lethal kind of combination here that has forced the Drug Enforcement Administration to make a public warning on Monday about the rise of overdose deaths from these counterfeit drugs laced with fentanyl. And last year there were 100,000 or close to 100,000 overdose deaths in America, and the numbers are growing, particularly amongst American teenagers. The lethal combination being the lax internet laws that allow teenagers to buy these counterfeit pills laced with fentanyl. I believe it's, 2 out of 5 are potentially lethal, according to the DEA. Then you've got the Sackler family of Purdue Pharma, who created the kind of gateway drug of oxycodone, which began the opioid pandemic and led to a lot of people moving into heroin and then fentanyl. And then the fact that the Chinese communist government is turning a blind eye to the manufacture of fentanyl in China itself. So are there any, am I missing something here?
I would say by now, actually, the Chinese government has cracked down a lot on manufacture of fentanyl. And now manufacturing fentanyl takes place in Mexico, for the most part. It can take place anywhere around the world. That's the point, though. The chemicals that are used to make fentanyl are very often sourced to China. And there's thousands of chemical companies in that country. So a lot of different, I think, underworld groups, most particularly the Mexican trafficking world, has figured out how to make fentanyl now. They didn't really know very well how to make fentanyl. That began to change, I think, three, four, or five years ago. And they now absolutely do. Maybe actually more like 5, 6 years ago, they began really to figure that out. And so now what's happening, they have control of the ports on the Pacific coast of Mexico. They, of course, famously have control, I would say, to the extent they need to, of law enforcement. And what this really is about is that we have now entered the era very fully of synthetic drugs. We've always had synthetic drugs, MDMA, ecstasy, that kind of stuff. We've had, but nothing remotely close to the supplies that the Mexican trafficking world is now able to make with access to these ports. What the synthetic drug era really means is for traffickers that you don't care about land anymore. You don't care about the seasons, rainfall, sunshine. That was for another era, the earlier era of the Mexican trafficking world. Now what you really care about is getting access to chemists and, of course, most importantly, getting access to ports from which you can access then the world chemical markets of all kinds of chemicals from China, of course, but other countries as well, Chile, Czech Republic, you name it, India. And that's why we are seeing just enormous, enormous quantities of these very, very potent drugs coming in from Mexico, mainly fentanyl, but also methamphetamine. And because there's so much of this, they are, I think what's one thing that's happening is that they're kind of looking for ways of repackaging it. And about 4 years ago, they figured out fentanyl was a perfect drug to put into counterfeit pills that look like legitimate branded, say Percocets, Xanax bars, oxycodone generic 30 milligrams was really the first one. And you could see the growth of those pills just take over. And really, I think it was most of all just a value added play in a sense. If we sell powder fentanyl, we can get X. If we sell these pills, we can get 2X or 3X, you know, and that's kind of what's been going on. It fits, though, with this kind of general idea that synthetic drugs are in every way more beneficial to the traffickers than plant-based drugs. They are easier to make, easier to smuggle. You can make them year-round. You don't require seasons. And frequently, in most cases, it involves a dramatic reduction in the supply chain and costs within the supply chain. So that's why you're seeing this enormous. So more and more people down in Mexico are beginning to produce this stuff with access to these chemicals, and you're seeing it. The death toll is the result.
And again, I'm speaking with Sam Quinones, who is a journalist, author, and storyteller, whose two acclaimed books of narrative nonfiction about Mexico and Mexico immigration, True Tales from Another Mexico, and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, made him, according to the San Francisco Chronicle Book Review, the most original writer on Mexico and the border. His latest books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, out in November. So obviously there's no quality control in terms of these clandestine labs in Mexico, and that is why the DEA made this unusual warning on Monday about how, what is it, 3 out of 5 pills on the market today are potentially
something like
lethal.
That they're seeing, and what I think that means is, you know, we think we call these groups down in Mexico cartels.
they really, economically, they are really not cartels. Cartels are organizations that form to constrict supply, to force up price. The exact opposite is happening out of Mexico today. What really happens and has been happening, particularly now with synthetic drugs, is because the chemicals are so easy to get on the world market, and the processes for making these drugs, meth and fentanyl both, are well understood and well known and not that difficult anymore for people to get their minds around. What you're beginning to see, I think, for the last several years, really, is just an explosion in the amount of people producing the stuff. The people who are really kind of the power brokers, I think, more than anything, what they're doing is controlling the supply of chemicals. They want to sell as many chemicals as they can, and so it doesn't bother them that so many people are getting involved in producing the stuff that the price drops to historic lows. Meth, for example, is now historic lows, and the meth that they're producing is in such enormous, staggering supply that it's covered the entire country. It used to be only really the western side of the United States that was covered by Mexican methamphetamine. Now it's all the way to New England, which never had any meth at all. And so what you're seeing is like this kind of glut economy taking place, and people are realizing in Mexico, but then also in the United States, that you can add particularly fentanyl to almost anything and it'll give it a boost. Plus, particularly at the local level, the street dealer level, and maybe a couple levels above that, they have found that if you add fentanyl to cocaine or methamphetamine, very quickly you get an opioid addict. You get an opioid addict, someone who has to buy your drug every single day. Unlike a cocaine user who's maybe like a weekend warrior kind of user, that kind of thing. Now, as soon as you get that person addicted to fentanyl, that person's going to have to be buying from you every single day. And that's what's also been going on. Now, the counterfeit pills are another issue, but certainly related in some way to just the enormous, enormous supply, extraordinarily cheap drug to make, and extraordinarily cheap, profitable drug to make as well.
Well, as it happens, Sam, I went to a birthday party last night and met a couple whose teenage son died from one of these counterfeit pills. And they have the entire chain on his phone from Snapchat.
Right.
It's so easy. Kids can get it literally sitting on their couch in their bedroom. They can call it up and have it delivered. And all this evidence was handed over to the L.A. sheriffs, and of course they turned out to be completely useless. So it doesn't make sense to, if you're a drug trafficker or a drug pusher, to kill your customers.
Well, you know, that's actually not true. But first let me talk about the pills and social media outlets, Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat. A few months ago, I went to a protest outside the headquarters of Snapchat in Santa Monica. 60 or so parents, going there with posters saying Snapchat is implicit in the overdose murder of my son or daughter or what have you. There's such enormous supply coming out of Mexico now that almost anybody could sell it and get access to it. So the access is always the big issue when you're dealing street dealing. And there is no access issue anymore. They're just everywhere. And so a lot of dealers have figured out that because of COVID, a lot of kids are spending so much time online, on their computers, on their phones, and they have been going there and offering these pills in very colorful menus. If you look at the menus, you'll see Percocets. You know, it's kind of like almost an ice cream parlor menu. You know, it looks like all colorful and everything. And then they'll also deliver it too. But the reason that's happening is because the amount of pills coming into the country now from Mexico containing fentanyl, looking like Xanax bars, looking like Percocets, looking like oxycodone 30 milligram, the amount of pills coming in from Mexico is just staggering. You know, now when it comes to whether or not traffickers want to kill their customers, most likely they don't, but really they don't particularly care. Also, once you have, and this has been achieved in a lot of regions across the country now, people are no longer, they know that what they're buying is fentanyl. And many times people are just simply addicted now to fentanyl. What's very common historically, going back many years, in the heroin world and the opiate addicted world, that when someone overdoses or someone dies of an overdose, that is not a warning. That is an advertisement. Because at that point, the addicted brain is so taken over by dope, so hijacked by dope, that the idea is wherever it's almost killing people, I want that dope. That people flock to it. People actually advertise that, or word of mouth say, hey, tell everybody my dope just put somebody on his butt, you know. And so you have a lot of people now who are simply addicted to fentanyl. They've developed tolerances to fentanyl, and they need fentanyl to keep them from getting dope sick, just the way they would on heroin. Heroin no longer does the trick. So along the way, people will die, and people have died. That's not always a bad thing from the trafficker's point of view, but that's kind of the twisted world that we're dealing in. That frequently nowadays, with so many people really just addicted to fentanyl, no matter what they call the stuff they're buying, they could call it heroin, but really doesn't contain any heroin at all. It's really just straight fentanyl most of the time. And those folks are now addicted to it. And when they hear somebody dying, they're going to rush to that dealer. In fact, nowadays, if you're known to sell dope that does not contain fentanyl, you really are going to at a competitive disadvantage on the street, I think.
Well, I was talking last night with the parents of a teenage boy who didn't have the tolerance, clearly, and that's where mm-hmm. it gets incredibly lethal. But I mentioned the Chinese manufacturing, and you've cleared that up, Sam, that the Chinese Communist government may have cracked down on the manufacture of fentanyl itself, but they have not been able or willing to crack down on the precursors, the chemicals, which are then shipped to Mexico. The Sacklers I mentioned, it seems to me that, I mean, they just got the most outrageous settlement. I mean, it is disgusting what happened with that settlement, where the family gets to keep its ill-gotten gains of billions of dollars, and the states that sued end up depending upon money coming from the further sale of oxycodone. Yeah. So it's just right. obscene. It shows you how that we live in this plutocracy where the super rich just can get away with it in the most shameful way. But did they create the gateway drug with this epidemic?
Certainly. And also, you know, what's been fascinating to read is over the last 5-6 years since my book came out, I have watched all these lawsuits be filed against the company, and along with that, usually filed by attorneys general, and virtually every attorney general in the country has now a lawsuit against the Sackler and Purdue Pharma. But along with that comes a great subpoena power, and so you can read these documents, internal documents, emails, memoranda, internal reports, and so on, about how they were viewing this, and they kind of understood. It's a remarkable thing, and I particularly urge people to go to the Attorney General of Tennessee and the Attorney General of Massachusetts if you want to have some really fascinating reading straight from the horse's mouth, straight from these documents that were subpoenaed about what the idea was. And the idea, they understood, I think, from the emails and the documents that are contained in them, they understood that people, it doesn't matter who you're talking about, what genetic predisposition you may or may not have to addiction. People, if they can keep them on OxyContin for 90 to 100 days, something like that, I think it was, there's a very good chance those patients will be on that drug 5 years later. It's very much like a drug trafficker calculation, right? The fentanyl story is really a story that's piggybacked on the opioid epidemic that began with drug companies like Purdue, principally, but others as well. And they're very, very aggressive marketing of what were actually narcotic drugs ought to be used very, very, judiciously to say, this is how we can cure pain in America. Just use it up and refills and all that. And what ends up happening is they create, again, this, as you said, like this kind of gateway to create, and they created this enormous new population of opiate dependent consumers. And so the trafficking world figured that out and got into it with heroin. But I think, frankly, at a certain point, we were using more heroin than they could actually produce. And eventually they began to switch to fentanyl. And this would have been 5 years ago, something like that. And so fentanyl has now crowded out heroin. So really, if you're a poppy grower in Mexico, you have you're basically in a depressed economic state. There's no market for what you're growing anymore. And it's really just now fentanyl that has kind of taken over the opioid addicted market that was bequeathed to the underworld by the very, very aggressive promotion of these pills by these companies and principally Purdue Pharma.
And the Sackler family.
Correct. Well, the Sackler family is Purdue Pharma. I should make that clear. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. they were the board members, but unlike other companies where the board members have a limited role, perhaps, or a very muted role, the Sackler family, from these reports, you can read the very, very aggressive daily management of Purdue, because they were also the owners. So they're on the board, but they're also the owners. And so therefore, and they also saw more prescriptions at an ever higher dose means more profits. That was the incentive. Had they just kept the, you know, it always seemed to me strange. Had they just kept their marketing to a kind of a muted kind of marketing? Had they marketed it only for terminal cancer patients and maybe a little bit for chronic pain, we'd probably be erecting statues in their honor. But they decided that there was a very small market. The great market, the big market they were after, was just all pain patients of any kind, and promoting the myth that, you know, that nobody, virtually nobody who's a pain patient can get addicted to these pills if they're prescribed them. And that led to a whole bunch of consequences that I wrote about in Dreamland, and led to us as a nation seeing the formation of this widespread coast-to-coast consumer base that now is easy pickings for the drug trafficking world out of Mexico.
So just in closing then, Sam Quiñones, we mentioned earlier about the use of Snapchat and these other social medias as ways for kids to literally get the drugs that can actually be delivered right to their homes. And the demonstrations that you witnessed and took part in Santa Monica in front of Snapchat's headquarters, that's the same rubric through which Facebook is able to get away with this argument, oh, we're only the piano player in the whorehouse. We have no responsibility for all this Nazi, neo-Nazi, hateful, crazy, anti-vaxxing, you name it, every stupid conspiracy theory, dangerous advice on taking dangerous drugs, you know, like horse-worming drugs and all this insanity that Zuckerberg still won't deal with because he doesn't really have to, because the same, this was passed in the Clinton administration under the FCC Communications Act. I think it's what, Section 230 or something? That means that these internet companies aren't publishers. They're not like journalists like you and me who have to be
responsible.
They're
not editors.
Editors, we have to be careful what we say and have to be able to back up what we say, otherwise we get sued. They can put anything out on their platforms, and that's their excuse.
Right.
And can that law be overturned?
You know, you'd be better off talking to a politician who's well versed in telecommunications, or an attorney or something. But that's exactly that's exactly right. The response, according to the parents that I interviewed at the protest, was that we can't be in the business of censoring, of editing. That's not our business. Our business is simply a platform. And then we deeply sympathize. We're commiserating with the families and so on. But we can't really do much to stop this. Now, I'm not sure exactly that's true. I've seen Craigslist used to be, in Los Angeles in particular, used to be a major venue for the sale of black tar heroin and fentanyl. I would say that Craigslist seems to have cracked down to some degree. All you really need, frankly, from what I saw with Craigslist, is to be clued into what the keywords are that people are using, you know, and if you can see that and you come to these sites, it's clear they're not selling what they claim to sell. If you read them you can see very clearly that it's a drug deal, and why that isn't worth hiring a few people to keep tabs on constantly, I don't understand. But that is the case, and the parents, very fervent, very dedicated, left empty-handed, was my understanding from the protest I went to, and I think it was in June of this past summer. And so you get, they understand, drug dealers understand, there's lots of kids. Again, this is a different market now, not created by the opioid epidemic. These are kids who are 14, 16. They are opioid naive, as doctors say. They'd have never taken any of this stuff. Or maybe they have, but a very minor way. And they're certainly do not have tolerance that would protect them against a pill containing fentanyl, for goodness sake.
Well, Sam Quinones, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you, Ian. Thanks so much for the chance to chat.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And again, I've been speaking with Sam Quinones, who's a journalist, author, and storyteller, whose two acclaimed books of narrative nonfiction about Mexico and Mexican immigration, True Tales from Another Mexico and Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, made him, according to the San Francisco Chronicle Book Review, the most original writer on Mexico and the border. His latest books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, out in November. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the 70 million Americans still not vaccinated and the growing use of religious exemptions by anti-vaxxers.
The damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anthea Butler, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, whose latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's something between 70 and 80 million Americans are still not vaccinated in the midst of this contagion of a lethal strain of COVID. And there's a growing use of religious exemptions by anti-vaxxers, and it seems to be a big part of evangelical America is in this anti-vaxxing world. Whether they're anti-vaxxers by that definition, whatever that is, I'm not sure. But it seems that much of what they believe basically are lies that underpin their belief system, particularly that the vaccines come from aborted fetuses. And of course, this is contradicted by the Pope and the Catholic Church, who have approved the use of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. So what's your understanding of the connection between anti-vaxxing and Christian evangelicals in this country?
Well, there's a lot of things that go into this, but I'm going to try to make it brief so that your listeners will understand that evangelicals have always had a controversial relationship with science. And we can go all the way back to the Scopes trial to think about that and their unacceptance of Darwinism. But in this particular case, there's several streams that are going through the anti-vaccine thing. First, we can go back to the beginning of the pandemic and talk about how people wanted to make sure that they were able to worship and that they didn't want their religious freedoms upset. And so the religious freedom argument is one strand of what's going on. But the deeper strand of what's going on right now is both sort of anti-vaccine rhetoric and even deeper than that, QAnon rhetoric that has kept people from getting vaccines. So the kinds of things that you've heard where the people are taking ivermectin or other kinds of things where they see this on Facebook or heard it from their pastor means that evangelicals have particularly been susceptible to both conspiracy theories and also the idea that the government is trying to either put a microchip into them trying to track them in some kind of way. And the anti-government strain that exists within American evangelicalism is also part and parcel of why they don't want to get vaccinated. And then there's this other piece, and I think this is worth talking about too. The other piece is that they believe that God has given them natural born immunity. In other words, their bodies should be able to combat COVID and they would get over it. And what they are finding out, unfortunately, is that their bodies are not able to push back COVID. And so what we're seeing now from a lot of people who are taking care of these folks in hospitals is that they are having to come to grips with the fact that they, in fact, don't have natural immunity, that their bodies, in fact, don't produce antibodies despite not having the vaccine, and that they are dying at a rate higher than the regular population because of being unvaccinated.
Well, it seems that the evangelical movement, particularly the televangelists in this country, are essentially a front for right-wing politics. But there's also a lot of hucksters and grifters involved in here, because you mentioned ivermectin, the deworming drug for horses, and hydroxychloroquine. There are groups that are actively selling this stuff. There's the group called Americans Frontline Doctors. There's another group called Cadence Health and Ravku. They're just making a killing. So I don't know whether they're in bed with these evangelicals who are recommending these ridiculous and dangerous. It's worse than snake oil. I was going to say it's horse oil or whatever.
Oh, it is.
So you mentioned the QAnon. Marjorie Taylor Greene invoked the Book of Revelation recently in a video in March, describing the Biden administration's plans to vaccinate with these what they call vaccine passports as the mark of the beast. So that seems to be spreading fairly rapidly, isn't it? That notion that somehow these vaccines have microchips in them, that Bill Gates is trying to track you. I mean, I know it sounds absurd, but I'm not making this up.
I know you're not. And the thing is that who would want to track these people to begin with? I mean, I think this is the overinflated sense of importance and superiority that a lot of these evangelicals have in terms of how they think about their relationship to the nation and to the world. It's navel gazing, but at the same time, it's grandiose ideas about themselves that really should not exist. But I want to come back to something that you said about America's Frontline Doctors, and everybody's going to forget this, but I would like to remind everybody about this. America's Frontline Doctors were involved with Donald Trump, where he had them come out and say that they were, you know, the hydroxychloroquine was great. But in reality, these doctors were related to different kinds of religious groups. And the fact that they're selling this, you know, ivermectin now is not surprising to me at all, because they've been around since the very beginning selling snake oil. Now, the other thing I think you should put into the mix is that there were other people selling snake oil, too, at the beginning of the pandemic, one of which notably was Jim Baker, who before having a stroke was actually selling a remedy that had silver in it to cure COVID-19, which of course was a poison that could make you very ill besides COVID. And he was sued about that and told to stop selling it. So, I mean, it's all a money-making grift for all these people. But the reality is if you take ivermectin, you might be run into the bathroom because you have the runs, because it's meant for a horse instead of a person. And I think that is the problem that we have now, is that these conspiracy theories have taken over so much so that there's actually people who have sued to be able to get ivermectin prescribed to them in the hospital while they are undergoing COVID-19 treatment.
And again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, whose latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. So, Anthea, what do you know about this evangelical character, Matt Staver, who appeared on an hour-long live stream hosted by the World Prayer Network, in which he told listeners that the vaccines for COVID-19 are not meant to save the world from the pandemic, but instead to depopulate the world?
You know, this is another one of those kind of things where I say people figure out a way to talk about this. He's a former Seventh Day Adventist pastor and dean of Liberty's Law School. So this is actually somebody who has been in a prominent position in evangelicalism. And I think that one of the things we have to do with people like Matt Staver and others is to realize that they are all part of a network. And these anti-vax conspiracies that they have are about having, you know, how do we make more, you know, visibility for myself? Do I need a TV show? Can I get on Fox News? Can I make sure that I am connected to all these networks? Because once you network yourself with everybody, then it makes it very important. And just recently he said he likened the whole thing about vaccination to Nazi Germany. And I mean, I think this is an absolute travesty. And he's leading people to their deaths, as we can see from all the overflowing hospitals in all the red states right now, that where normal people who just have a normal everyday illness that needs to be treated can't be treated because all of the people who have been led astray by people like Straver are jamming up the hospitals and keeping people away.
Well, I often wonder about where is the religious left encountering the lunacy and influence of the religious right. And I don't know what can be employed in this particular case, because the 70 to 80 million unvaccinated Americans are endangering us all. Yeah. And we shouldn't take it lying down, because, and they're endangering our children, by the way, and the most vulnerable among us. It's absolutely outrageous what's happening. So what about the Pope's message that the Catholic Church has okayed the use of Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines, in spite of the belief amongst evangelicals that the vaccines are made from aborted fetuses, which is not the case?
Yeah, I think this is great that the Vatican is like, we're not going to take this mess from anybody. You need to be vaccinated or we're moving you off like everybody else. And I think one of the things that is very clear to me is to combat people in the Catholic Church who are also spreading this message. A few months ago, maybe a month or two ago, Cardinal Burke, who was a very big anti-vaccine proponent, was in the hospital on a ventilator. And we have not heard very much about him since he was released and sent to a rehab center. But he was a very big anti-vaxxer. And I believe that the Pope is making a firm stand on this, in part because of people like him who have been leading people astray, basically. I mean, I think that these people claim to love God very much, but what they're also doing is killing people with these kinds of conspiracy theories and disinformation about vaccines.
So what can our listeners do here, particularly when I say we have a personal stake in this, Anthea, because these people are threatening our lives and particularly the lives of our vulnerable children?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we can do is you have to try to have patience to talk to people and say, basically, it's not just about you. This is not just your personal choice. This is a choice that affects everyone. I was in a car service the other day, and the gentleman told me that he had had a heart attack at 38 and that he wasn't taking the vaccine, but that he was taking care of himself because, you know, he tried to get back on his exercise program and he's eating well. And I said to him, lettuce can't kill COVID. And so I think for these people who would rather go to all of these different remedies and everything else, what I would say to them are two things. Number one, do you have the money to pay your hospital bill when you get in the hospital or your child gets in the hospital and you get thousands upon thousands of dollars worth of a bill that the hospital won't pay because you did not get vaccinated? That's number one. And number two, are you prepared to live without your children, to either leave your child parentless or to lose your child to COVID because you won't get vaccinated? And I think it's time to take a hard line against people. Today in the news, I saw that United Airlines is going to fire 600 people who did not decide to get the vaccine. And I just said, basically, I'm like, there's 600 jobs out here. Y'all want to get a job? You're vaccinated? Go to United. So I think we have to start being really much more punitive to these people, because honestly, this is the only thing that evangelicals understand is punitive punishment. And if they believe that they'll get punished and shunned from society because they won't get the vaccine, then I think we might have a better uptick of these people getting vaccinated and saving their lives and the lives of their loved ones and our lives as well.
Well, Anthea Butler, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and her latest book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump's postmaster general, who is under FBI investigation, is deliberately slowing down the mail in a shift from airmail to trucking that will enrich his former trucking company he holds a financial stake in. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christopher Shaw, an author, historian, and policy analyst, who is the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic, and the forthcoming book, First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. And he has a recent article at Foreign Affairs, The U.S. Postal Service Was Designed to Serve Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Shaw.
Glad to be here.
So this Postmaster General Louis DeJoy that Trump put in there, who at the time when we needed mail-in ballots for the elections, there was a great deal of controversy because he got rid of all the sorting machines. And the feeling was that he was deliberately destroying the post office in order to help Trump, because Trump objected to mail-in ballots. He's still there. He's under investigation by the FBI, which from what we can learn in from reporting is that he apparently got his employees to make political donations at his direction. And this is something that other chief executives have gone to federal prison for. So why is this man still there?
Well, he's still there because he, as the Postmaster General, is not actually a direct presidential appointee. It's the Postmaster General is a position that's selected by the Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors are presidential appointees, and who are then confirmed by the Senate. And the thing is that Biden only has been able to appoint three new governors, but the full complement of governors on the board is equal to nine. So you have a lot of holdover governors who were there and picked DeJoy in the first place, and they have are still supporting DeJoy and his plans at this point. So until a majority of the Board of Governors decides that they no longer want DeJoy to serve as Postmaster General, he stays in the position. So again, Biden appointed those three governors, three new governors, but at this point, it's still a majority support having DeJoy serve.
What's the voting breakdown then of Trumpsters versus, in fact, the chair of the board is supposedly a Democrat, Ron Blum, but he was appointed by Trump.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's a couple Democrats on there who were appointed by Trump, including the chair, Ron Blum. And Ron Blum has been supportive of DeJoy's plans. Blum has an interesting background. He worked for Wall Street, but he also worked for the Steelworkers Union. And he had a lot of experience in kind of restructuring industrial corporations to then reorganize them and make them viable. And he seems to be approaching the Postal Service perhaps with this kind of mindset again. But what's missing there is the fact that the Postal Service, it's not a profit-making corporation. It's a government service. But as of yet, he still seems to be in support of these plans. And a lot of DeJoy's critics put Blum at this point right up there with him in terms of who's responsible for this state of affairs.
But now DeJoy is announcing that they're going to slow down first-class mail delivery. I mean, how can you continue in a job where what you're doing is creating higher charges for postal services, slower services, and reduced post office hours? The suspicion has always been that he's put in there essentially to destroy the postal service, that You know, I mean, the House under George W. Bush passed this onerous requirement on the part of the Postal Service to prepay 75 years of pensions, which nobody else, no private company or public entity has ever had to do. And so that's crippled the Postal Service. So that seems to be, again, some deliberate ideological decision on the part of free marketeers to get rid of the post office and have us at the mercy of FedEx and UPS. So is that the subtext here?
Well, this decision is based on the idea that it will save money if you take the plane, the mail off of airplanes, and you put more of it on trucks. And of course, one interesting point here is that DeJoy's background is in the trucking industry. But he wants more mail on trucks. And so that means if you live in kind of the extremities of the nation, so portions of New England, Florida, Texas, but especially in the western part of the United States, and particularly along the Pacific coast, then your mail is going to be delayed. It can be, in some cases, delayed by a day or even 2 days. And the irony here is that when airmail service began back in 1920, the first route between New York City and San Francisco, it took 3.5 days for a letter to travel from coast to coast. And now it could take potentially as much as, 4 or 5 days. So it's he's really slowing down and reducing the standards. And it doesn't seem like if you're trying to have a stable and vibrant postal service in the future, that reducing service is the best way to do this. For instance, I know Wells Fargo Bank actually contacted its depositors and suggested that they do more of their banking online, get their statements online, things like that. So when the mail is slower, that's going to encourage people not to use the mail. And so that's where the issue you raise comes into play. By cutting service, you make the Postal Service less effective, less efficient, and really less something that people can depend on to get their mail where they need it, when they need it to be there. So that's where things stand. And, you know, the real issue here, if you had a kind of were to take an innovative and expansive approach to the Postal Service, would be to say it's time for the Postal Service to get its own fleet of aircraft. It's always had to depend on airlines or even competitors like UPS and FedEx to carry its mail. And so it should be allowed to get its own fleet of aircraft. And just to raise this issue and have a discussion about it, that would be an innovative approach. But instead, we're getting an approach which actually kind of turns the clock back, and we're slowing down the mail and putting more of it on trucks.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Shaw, who's an author, historian, and policy analyst, who is the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. And his forthcoming book is First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. And he has a recent article at Foreign Affairs, The U.S. Postal Service Was Designed to Serve Democracy. So is this yet another one of these Republican gambits to punish successful blue states like California? They did that with the removing the state and local tax deductions, which have, obviously it was just petty on their part. So the idea that mail service is now going to be slower in California, is that anything to do with that kind of mindset that, they reward these failed states like Mississippi, who California subsidizes, and punish successful economies like California's, which I think is something like the fifth largest economy in the world?
California will definitely be bearing the brunt of this kind of slowdown, and a number of other states that are blue as well. But it won't solely be blue states, because you're going to have, like, for example, Texas and Florida, which is looking more and more like a red state, all the time. It's not the swing state. It seems that a lot of people might hope that it would be. They're going to have delays, too. So I think it really does have mostly to do with the transportation network and just what happens when you start taking mail off of airplanes and just putting it on trucks, and the fact that it has to travel a greater distance. And it's going to take more time when it's on a truck rather than on an aircraft.
And it's hardly a coincidence that the company that DeJoy ran is a trucking company that serves the Postal Service, right?
I think that this is a problem where when you have people running this government service, a government agency, and they don't come from a public service background. And so that's not the priority. But what you do have is, in this case, someone who does come from a trucking background and really knows about the trucking industry and seems to approach it from that standpoint, from the standpoint of trucking. And, you know, there's potential conflicts of interest there as well that are being looked into. But we really need to have people on the Board of Governors and also as the Postmaster General who have a commitment to public service and come with that viewpoint when it comes time to think about what the Postal Service is and how it should operate. So this has been an ongoing issue now for a long time with this lack of a public service mindset amongst the people who are the officials who run our nation's post office.
But they're put there deliberately by politicians who have the same mindset, or indeed, there may well be corruption involved. This is the problem, isn't it? You've got Ron Blum and these others on the board, and they're not listening to public opinion. They don't seem to care that the service is getting worse and worse and made deliberately worse and worse by their decisions. This is kind of thuggery, isn't it? I mean, what can you do?
There clearly is a problem with politicians who think that the Postal Service should be privatized. They think it should be run like a business. And therefore, they think the people who should run it are people with a background in business who have no understanding of public service. And that's a clear problem. I mean, I think the fortunate thing, though, is that certainly the Postal Service is the most highly thought of government agency out there, is what all the polling tells us. It's a very high approval rating. And so most Americans, they like the post office, they appreciate the service it provides, they understand its value. And so that's what's on our side of maintaining this democratic public service that we need. But you're absolutely right that there are unfortunately too many politicians who do have a commitment to privatization and have no understanding of the public service ethos that the Postal Service is all about.
Right, but it's one thing to have no understanding of public service and have this sort of free enterprise bias. But it's another thing to actively sabotage the United States Postal Service, which is what the House did back during George W. Bush's administration by forcing it to prepay 75 years of pensions, which has crippled them financially. And now on top of that, they put this Dracula in charge of the blood bank in the form of DeJoy, you know, who, as we started out, said, you know, during the elections, got rid of all the sorting machines to slow down, mail-in balloting, which is something that Trump had wanted to happen. So I'm not being conspiratorial. I mean, this is all glaring us in the face, isn't it?
I think there should be serious consideration given to the fact that the Postal Service, it used to be, it was a political branch of government. It was part of the Postmaster General served on the cabinet. And then it was reorganized in 1971 to what was supposed to be an apolitical organization. But if you're going to nominate someone as Postmaster General, who was a finance chairman for the Republican National Convention and gave over $1 million to the sitting president, then although this person is not nominated directly by the president, I think there's an issue there. And so I think that, you know, it should be looked into perhaps putting in some safeguards. If this is supposed to be an apolitical organization, then there shouldn't be these kinds of questions, the exact ones that you're raising, about the political management or mismanagement of the agency.
And what do we know about the rank and file? I mean, the fact that DeJoy managed to get the employees of the U.S. Postal Service to make political donations to his candidates, I assume that they were to Trump, which is what the FBI is looking into. What do you know about the morale of the Postal Service itself?
The major issue with the Postal Service that you hear time and again from postal workers is the fact that they are incredibly short-staffed and overworked. There just aren't enough postal workers to really process and deliver and sort the mail at the standard that we have come to expect over all these years. And so it's a real problem with the lack of staffing there, and that needs to be addressed. And I think it's, you know, really impacted the morale. And then these kinds of ongoing questions, as we've been discussing, are compounded on top of that. So that is a real issue.
Well, DeJoy did testify before, I think it was a House committee a little while back, and he was completely defiant. I use the word thuggery. I mean, he acted like a thug, like, screw you, you know, I'm in here, I'm in control, you can't get rid of me, you know, we've stacked the board in my favor, and, you know, you can complain as much as you like, but I'm not going anywhere. That was his attitude.
Yeah, no, he said, I'm going to be here a long time. And as long as he has the support of the majority of the board, there's really not much of anything you can do to get him, you know, out of there. So he will be there as long as he has that support.
And this is in spite of the fact that both Democrats and Republicans want this guy out. And a lot of rural areas are served by the U.S. Post Office. And these are in red states, and they are tend to be Republican, and they rely on the Postal Service. So is there any way to organize the majority of the people in this country across bipartisan lines to somehow force this issue? Is this a clash between the powerful insiders who game the system versus the public?
I think that the post office is one question where, you know, in a nation that's deeply divided along partisan lines these days, where there is a remarkable amount of bipartisan agreement, because, as you said, that all these rural Republicans, for example, they want a functioning, healthy post office as well. So I think that there is that potential there. And I've got to think that when you continue to have these kinds of degradation of the service levels, that is going to make people more aware of what's going on. And they're going to have more of a watchdog function on the Postal Service and do what they can to push back and to make sure that it remains the kind of first-class public service that we all should expect to have.
So just in closing then, Christopher Shore, is that our only recourse? Is to somehow, I don't know who's going to organize this bipartisan lobby to push back against DeJoy, and particularly this guy, Richard Bloom, who's the head of the board of the Postal Service, who's keeping him in power.
The American people have done a pretty good job in the last year, I think, of educating themselves about the issue and organizing themselves. I mean, you saw the outpouring of, you know, the protests, the letters to Congress people, the phone calls, all those things that happened last August when the vote by mail system seemed to be in jeopardy. And I think that kind of heightened awareness is still there. So these things don't happen overnight, but I do see a much higher degree of engagement with the issue. And I think that is a hopeful sign going forward.
Yeah, and then that public pressure did get DeJoy to back down on ripping out the sorting machines, et cetera, right? So
that's right. Yep.
Yeah.
Sure did.
Well, Christopher Shore, I thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Shore, who's an author, historian, and policy analyst, and the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. And his forthcoming book is First Class, The U.S. Postal Service, Democracy, and the Corporate Threat. And he has a recent article at Foreign Affairs, The U.S. Postal Service Was Designed to Serve Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.